the paper from his hands before continuing. "Their crime is far more significant," it went on, its voice lowered. It began to read in the same whisper, precising the text of the paper. "They were executed a week ago for making an attempt on the Ortak's life while he and his entourage were on their peace mission in Vanayev."
"Are you kidding?"
"No joke. That's what it says."
"Did they succeed?"
"Of course not." The mister fell silent while it scanned the columns. "It says they killed three of his advisors with a bomb and injured 11 soldiers. The device was... wait, my Omutajivak is rusty. The device was smuggled into his presence by Pontiff Farrell. They were all caught alive, it says, but hanged dead, which means they died under torture, but the Ortak made a show of the execution anyway."
"That's fucking barbaric."
"It's very common, particularly in political trials."
"What about Tik Roar? Why's his picture in there?"
"He was named as a co-conspirator, but apparently he escaped, the damn fool."
"Why'd you call him that?"
"Getting involved in politics when there's so much more at stake. It's not the first time, of course, and won't be the last."
"I'm not following."
"People get frustrated with waiting, and they end up stooping to politics, but it's so short-sighted, stupid sod."
"How well do you know him?"
"Who, Tik Roar?" The placid features were momentarily confounded. Then Pye said, "He has a certain reputation, shall we say. They'll find him for certain. There isn't a sewer in the Dominions he'll be able to hide his head in."
"Why should you care?"
"Keep your voice down. Answer the question," Gentle replied, dropping his volume as he spoke. "He was a maestro, Gentle. He called himself an evocator. But it amounts to the same thing. He had power."
"Then why was he living in the middle of a shithole like Vanayev?"
"Not everybody cares about wealth and women, Gentle. Some souls have higher ambition."
"Such as?"
"Wisdom. Remember why we came on this journey? To understand. That's a fine ambition." Pye looked at Gentle, making eye-to-eye contact for the first time since the episode on the platform. "Your ambition, my friend. You and Tik Roar had a lot in common."
"And he knew it?"
"Oh, yes."
"Is that why he was so riled when I wouldn't sit down and talk with him?"
"I'd say so."
"Shit.
Hamriok and Farrow must have taken us for spies, come to wheedle out plots laid against the Ortak."
"But Tik Roar saw the truth."
"He did. He was once a great man, Gentle. At least, that was the rumor. I suppose he's dead or being tortured, which is grim news for us."
"You think he'll name us?"
"Who knows? Maestros have ways of protecting themselves from torture, but even the strongest man can break under the right kind of pressure."
"Are you saying we've got the Ortak on our tails?"
"I think we'd know it if we had. We've come a long way from Vanayev. The trail's probably cold by now."
"And maybe they didn't arrest Tik, eh? Maybe he escaped."
"They still caught Hamriok and the Pontiff. I think we can assume they've got a hair-by-hair description of us."
Gentle laid his head back against the seat.
"Shit," he said. "We're not making many friends, are we?"
"All the more reason that we don't lose each other," the mistiff replied.
The shadows of passing bamboo flickered on its face, but it looked at him unblinking.
"Whatever harm you believe I may have done you, now or in the past, I apologize for it. I'd never wish you any hurt, Gentle. Please believe that. Not the slightest."
"I know," Gentle murmured. "And I'm sorry too, truly."
"Shall we agree to postpone our argument until the only opponents we've got left in the Imagica are each other?"
"That may be a very long time."
"All the better."
Gentle laughed.
"Agreed,"
he said, leaning forward and taking the mistiff's hand.
"We've seen some amazing sights together, haven't we?"
"Indeed we have."
"Back there in my care, I was losing my sense of how marvellous all this is."
"We've got a lot more wonders to see."
"Just promise me one thing."
"Ask it."
"Don't eat raw fish in eyeshot of me again. It's more than a man can take."
2. From the yearning way that Hairstone Banty had described Limby, Gentle had been expecting some kind of Kathmandu,
a city of temples, pilgrims, and free dope. Perhaps it had been that way once, in Banti's long-lost youth. But when, a few minutes after night had fallen, Gentle and Pi stepped off the train, it was not into an atmosphere of spiritual calm. There were soldiers at the station gates, most of them standing idle, smoking and talking, but a few casting their eyes over the disembarking passengers. As luck had it, however, another train had arrived at an adjacent platform minutes before, and the gateway was choked with passengers, many hugging their life's belongings. It wasn't difficult for Pi and Gentle to dig their way through to the densest part of the crowd and pass unnoticed through the turnstiles and out of the station. There were many more troops in the wide lamplit streets, their presence no less disturbing for the air of lassitude that hung about them. The uncommissioned ranks wore a drab grey, but the officers wore white, which suited the subtropical night. All were conspicuously armed. Gentle made certain not to study either men or weaponry too closely, for fear of attracting unwelcome attention, but it was clear from even a furtive glance that both the armaments and the vehicles parked in every other alleyway were of the same elaborately intimidating design as he'd seen in Beatrix. The warlords of Isorderex were clearly past masters in the crafts of death, their technology several generations beyond that of the locomotive that had brought the travellers here. To Gentle's eye, the most fascinating sight was not the tanks or the machine guns, however. It was the presence among these troops of a subspecies he'd not encountered hitherto. Ethax, Pi called them. They stood no taller than their fellows, but their heads made up a third or more of that height, their squat bodies grotesquely broad to bear the weight of such a massive load of bone. Easy targets, Gentle remarked, but Pi whispered that their brains were small, their skulls thick, and their tolerance for pain heroic, the latter evidenced by the extraordinary array of livid scars and disfigurements they all bore on skin that was as white as the bone it concealed. It seemed this substantial military presence had been in place for some time, because the populace went about their evening business as if these men and their killing machines were completely commonplace. There was little sign of fraternization, but there was no harassment either.
"Where do we go from here?"
Gentle asked Pi, once they were clear of the crowds around the station.
"Skopik lives in the northeast part of the city, close to the temples. He's a doctor, very well respected."
"You think he may still be practicing?"
"He doesn't mend bones, Gentle. He's a doctor of theology. He used to like the city because it was so sleepy."
"It's changed, then."
"It certainly has. It looks as though it's got rich."
There was evidence of Limby's newfound wealth everywhere, in the gleaming buildings, many of them looking as though the paint on their doors was barely dry, in the proliferation of styles among the pedestrians, and in the number of elegant automobiles on the street. There were a few signs still remaining of the culture that had existed here before the city's fortunes had boomed. Beasts of burden still wove among the traffic, honked at and cursed. A smattering of facades had been preserved from older buildings and incorporated, usually crudely, into the designs of the newer. And then there were the living facades, the faces of the people Gentle and Pi were mingling with. The natives had a physical peculiarity unique to the region, clusters of small crystalline growths, yellow and purple, on their heads, sometimes arranged like crowns or coxcombs, but just as often erupting from the middle of the forehead or irregularly placed around the mouth. To Pi's knowledge, they had no particular function, but they were clearly viewed as a disfigurement by the sophisticates, many of whom went to extraordinary lengths to disguise their commonality of stock with the undecorated peasants. Some of these stylists wore hats, veils, and makeup to conceal the evidence. Others had tried surgery to remove the growths and went proudly about unhatted, wearing their scars as proof of their wealth.
"It's grotesque," Pi said when Gentle remarked upon this, "but that's the pernicious influence of fashion for you. These people want to look like the models they see in the magazines from Patashokwa, and the stylists in Patashokwa have always looked to the Fifth for their inspiration. Damn fools. Look at them. I swear if we were to spread the rumour that everyone in Paris is cutting off their right arms these days, we'd be tripping over hacked-off limbs all the way to Skopik's house."
"It wasn't like this when you were here?"
"Not in Limby. As I said, it was a place of meditation. But in Patashokwa, yes, always, because it's so close to the Fifth, so the influence is very strong.
And there's always been a few minor maestros, you know, travelling back and forth, bringing styles, bringing ideas. A few of them made a kind of business of it, crossing the In Ovo every few months to get news of the fifth and selling it to the fashion houses, the architects, and so on. So damn decadent. It revolts me.
But you did the same thing, didn't you?
You became part of the Fifth Dominion.
Never here,
the Mystiff said, its fist to its chest. Never in my heart. My mistake was getting lost in the In Ovo and letting myself be summoned to Earth. When I was there, I played the human game, but only as much as I had to.
Despite their baggy and by now well-crumpled clothes, both Pye and Gentle were bareheaded and smooth-skulled, so they attracted a good deal of attention from envious poseurs parading on the pavement. It was far from welcome, of course. If Pye's theory was correct and Hamriok or Pontiff Farrow had described them to the Autarch's torturers, their likenesses might very well have appeared in the broadsheets of Limby. If so, an envious dandy might have them removed from the competition with a few words in a soldier's ear. Would it not be wiser, Gentle suggested, if they hailed a taxi and travelled a little more discreetly? The Mystiff was reluctant to do so, explaining that it could not remember Scopeek's address, and their only hope of finding it was to go on foot, while Pye followed its nose. They made a point of avoiding the busier parts of the street, however, where café customers were outside enjoying the evening air, or, less frequently, where soldiers gathered. Though they continued to attract interest and admiration, nobody challenged them, and after 20 minutes they turned off the main thoroughfare, the well-tended buildings giving way within a couple of blocks to grimier structures, the fops to grimmer souls.
"This feels safer," Gentle said. A paradoxical remark given that the streets they were wandering through now were the kind they would have instinctively avoided in any city of the Fifth, ill-lit backwaters where many of the houses had fallen into severe disrepair. Lamps burned in even the most dilapidated, however, and children played in the gloomy streets despite the lateness of the hour. Their games were those of Earth, give or take a detail, not filched, but invented by young minds from the same basic materials, a ball and a bat, some chalk and a pavement, a rope and a rhyme. Gentle found it reassuring to walk among them and hear their laughter, which was indistinguishable from that of human children. Eventually the tenanted houses gave way to total dereliction, and it was clear from the Mystiff's disgruntlement that it was no longer sure of its whereabouts. Then a little noise of pleasure as it caught sight of a distant structure.
"That's the temple," Pye pointed to a monolith, some miles from where they stood. It was unlit and seemed forsaken, the ground in its vicinity levelled. "Scopeek had that view from his toilet window, I remember. On fine days, he said he used to throw open the window and contemplate and defecate simultaneously."
Smiling at the memory, the Mystiff turned its back on the sight.
The bathroom faced the temple, and there were no more streets between the house and the temple. It was common land for the pilgrims to pitch their tents.
"So we're walking in the right direction," Gentle said. "We just need the last street on our right."
"That seems logical," Pye said. "I was beginning to doubt my memory."
They didn't have much farther to look. Two more blocks and the rubble-strewn streets came to an abrupt end.
"This is it."
There was no triumph in Pye's voice, which was not surprising given the scene of devastation before them. While it was time that had undone the splendour of the streets they'd passed through, this last had been prey to more systematic assault. Fires had been set in several of the houses. Others looked as though they'd been used for target practice by a panzer division.
"Somebody got here before us," Gentle said.
"So it seems," Pye replied. "I must say I'm not altogether surprised."
"So why the hell did you bring us here?"
"I had to see for myself," Pye said. "Don't worry. The trail doesn't end here. He'll have left a message."
Gentle didn't remark on how unlikely he thought this, but followed the Mystiff along the street until it stopped in front of a building that, while not reduced to a heap of blackened stones, looked ready to succumb. A fire had eaten out its eyes, and the once fine door had been replaced with partially rotted timbers. All this illuminated not by lamplight, the street had none, but by a scattering of stars.
"Better you stay out here," Pio Pa said. "Scopeek may have left defences."
"Like what?"
"The Unbeheld isn't the only one who can conjure guardians," Pye replied. "Please, Gentle,
I prefer to do this alone.
Gentle shrugged.
Do as you wish, he said.
Then, as an afterthought,
you usually do.
He watched Pi climb the debris-covered steps, pull several of the timbers off the door, and slip out of sight. Rather than wait at the threshold, Gentle wandered farther along the road to get another view of the temple, musing as he went that this dominion, like the fourth, had confounded not only his expectations, but those of Pi as well. The safe haven of Vaneyev had almost seen their execution, or the murderous wastes of the mountains had offered resurrections, and now Limby, a sometime city of meditation, reduced to gourd and rubble. What next, he wondered. Would they arrive in Isordrex only to find it had spurned its reputation as the Babylon of the Dominions and become a new Jerusalem? He stared across at the shadowy temple, his mind straying back to a subject that had occupied him several times on their journey through the third, how best to address the challenge of making a map of the Dominions, so that when they finally returned to the Fifth Dominion, he could give his friends some sense of how the lands lay. They'd travelled on all kinds of roads, from the Patashokwan Highway to the dirt tracks between Happy and Maike. They'd wound through verdant valleys and scaled heights where even the hardiest moss would perish. They'd had the luxury of chariots and the loyalty of Doikai. They'd sweated and frozen and gone dreamily like poets into some place of fancy, doubting their senses and themselves. All this needed setting down. The routes, the cities, the ranges, and the plains all needed laying in two dimensions to be pored over at leisure. In time, he thought, putting the challenge off yet again, in time. He looked back towards Skopeek's house. There was no sign of Pi emerging, and he began to wonder if some harm had befallen the mischief inside. He walked back to the steps, climbed them, and, feeling a little guilty, slid through the gap between the timbers. The starlight had more difficulty getting in than he did, and his blindness put a chill in him, bringing to mind the measureless darkness of the ice cathedral. On that occasion the mischief had been behind him, this time in front. He waited a few seconds at the door until his eyes began to make out the interior. It was a narrow house, full of narrow places, but there was a voice in its depths, barely above a whisper, which he pursued, stumbling through the murk. After only a few paces he realized it was not Pi speaking, but someone hoarse and panicked. Skopeek, perhaps, still taking refuge in the ruins? A glimmer of light, no brighter than the dimmest star, led him to a door through which he had sight of the speaker. Pi was standing in the middle of the blackened room, turned from Gentle. Over the mischief's shoulder, Gentle saw the light's fading source, a shape hanging in the air, like a web woven by a spider that aspired to portraiture and held aloft by the merest breeze. Its motion was not arbitrary, however. The gossamer face opened its mouth and whispered its wisdom.
No better proof than in these cataclysms. We must hold to that, my friend. Hold to it and pray. No, better not pray. I doubt every god now, especially the aboriginal. If the children are any measure of the father, then he's no lover of justice or goodness.
Children, said Gentle.
The breath the word came upon seemed to flutter in the threads. The face grew long, the mouth tearing. The mischief glanced behind and shook its head to silence the trespasser. Skopeek, for this was surely his message, was talking again.
Believe me when I say we only know about the tenth part of a tenth part of the plots laid in this. Long before the reconciliation, forces were at work to undo it. That's my firm belief, and it's reasonable to assume that those forces have not perished. They're working in this dominion, and the dominion from which you've come. They strategize not in terms of decades, but centuries, just as we've had to, and they've buried their agents deeply. Trust nobody, Pi, O Pa, not even yourself. Their plots go back before we were born. We could either one of us have been conceived to serve them in some oblique fashion and not know it. They're coming for me very soon, probably with voiders. If I'm dead, you'll know it. If I can convince them I'm just a harmless lunatic, they'll take me off to the cradle, put me in the Maison de Santé. Find me there, Pi, oh Pa, or if you have more pressing business, then forget me. I won't blame you. But, friend, Whether you come for me or not, know that when I think of you, I still smile. And in these days, that is the rarest comfort.
Even before he'd finished speaking, the gossamer was losing its power to capture his likeness, the features softening, the form sinking in upon itself, until, by the time the last of his message had been uttered, there was little left for it to do but flutter to the ground. The mystiff went down on its haunches and ran its fingers through the inert threads.
Skopeek, it murmured.
What's the cradle he talked about?
The cradle of Jasemit. It's an inland sea, 2 or 3 days' journey from here.
You've been there?
No, it's a place of exile. There's an island in the cradle which was used as a prison, mostly for criminals who'd committed atrocities but were too dangerous to execute.
I don't follow that.
Ask me another time. The point is, it sounds like it's been turned into an asylum.
Pi stood up.
Poor Skopeek. He always had a terror of insanity.
I know the feeling,
Gentle remarked.
And now they've put him in a madhouse.
So we must get him out,
Gentle said very simply. He couldn't see Pi's expression, but he saw the mischief's hands go up to its face and heard a sob from behind its palms.
Aye,
Gentle said softly, embracing Pi.
We'll find him. I know I shouldn't have come spying like that, but I thought maybe something had happened to you.
At least you've heard him for yourself. You know it's not a lie.
Why would I think that?
Because you don't trust me, Pi said.
I thought we'd agreed, Gentle said. We've got each other, and that's our best hope of staying alive and sane. Didn't we agree to that?
Yes.
So let's hold to it.
It may not be so easy. If Skopeek's suspicions are correct, either one of us could be working for the enemy and not know it.
By enemy, you mean the Autark?
He's one, certainly. But I think he's just a sign of some greater corruption. The Imagicus sick, Gentle, from end to end. Coming here and seeing the way Limby's changed makes me want to despair.
You know, you should have forced me to sit down and talk with Tik Raw. He might have given us a few clues.
It's not my place to force you to do anything. Besides, I'm not sure he'd have been any wiser than Skopeek.
Maybe he'll know more by the time we speak with him.
Let's hope so.
And this time I won't take umbrage and waltz off like an idiot.
If we get to the island, there'll be nowhere to waltz to.
True enough. So now we need a means of transport.
Something anonymous.
Something fast.
Something easy to steal.
Do you know how to get to the cradle?
Gentle asked.
No, but I can inquire around while you steal the car.
Good enough. Oh, and Pi? Buy some booze and cigarettes while you're at it, will you?
You'll make a decadent of me yet.
My mistake. I thought it was the other way round.
3. They left Limby well before dawn in a car that Gentle chose for its colour, grey, and its total lack of distinction. It served them well. For 2 days they travelled without incident on roads that were less trafficked the farther from the temple city and its spreading suburbs they went. There was some military presence beyond the city perimeters, but it was discreet and no attempt was made to stop them. Only once did they glimpse a contingent at work in a distant field, vehicles manoeuvring heavy artillery into position behind barricades pointing back towards Limby, the work just public enough to let the citizens know whose clemency their lives were conditional upon. By the middle of the 3rd day, however, the road they were travelling was almost entirely deserted, and the flatlands in which Limby was set had given way to rolling hills. Along with this change of landscape came a change of weather. The skies clouded, and with no wind to press them on, the clouds thickened. A landscape that might have been enlivened by sun and shadow became drear, almost dank. Signs of habitation dwindled. Once in a while they'd pass a homestead, long since fallen into ruin. More infrequently still they'd catch sight of a living soul, usually unkempt, always alone, as though the territory had been given over to the lost. And then the cradle. It appeared, suddenly, the road taking them up over a headland which presented them with a sudden panorama of grey shore and silver sea. Gentle had not realised how oppressed he'd been by the hills until this vista opened in front of them. He felt his spirits rise at the sight. There were peculiarities, however, most particularly the thousands of silent birds on the stony beach below, all sitting like an audience awaiting some spectacle to appear from the arena of the sea, not one in the air or on the water. It wasn't until Pye and Gentle reached the perimeter of this roosting multitude and got out of the car that the reason for their inactivity became apparent. Not only were they and the sky above them immobile, so was the cradle itself. Gentle made his way through the mingled nations of birds. A close relation of the gull predominated, but there were also geese, oyster catchers, and a smattering of parrots, to the edge, testing it first with his foot, then with his fingers. It wasn't frozen. He knew what ice felt like from bitter experience. It was simply solidified. The last wave, still plainly visible, every curl and eddy fixed as it broke against the shore. "At least we won't have to swim," the Mistiff said. It was already scanning the horizon, looking for Scopeak's prison. The far shore wasn't visible, but the island was, a sharp grey rock rising from the sea several miles from where they stood, the Maison de Santé, as Scopeak had called it, a cluster of buildings teetering on its heights.
"Do we go now, or wait until dark?"
Gentle asked.
"We'll never find it after dark," Pye said. "We have to go now."
They returned to the car and drove down through the birds, who were no more inclined to move for wheels than they'd been for feet. A few took to the air briefly, only to flutter down again. Many more stood their ground and died for their stoicism. The sea made the best road they'd travelled since the Potashokwan Highway. It had apparently been as calm as a millpond when it had solidified. They passed the corpses of several birds who'd been caught in the process, and there were still meat and feathers on their bones, suggesting that the solidification had occurred recently.
"I've heard of walking on water," Gentle said as they drove, "but driving, there's a whole other miracle."
"Have you any idea what we're going to do when we get to the island?" Pye said.
"We ask to see Scopeak, and when we've found him, we leave with him. If they refuse to let us see him, we use force. It's simple as that."
"They may have armed guards."
"See these hands," Gentle said, taking them off the wheel and thrusting them at Pye. "These hands are lethal."
He laughed at the expression on the Mistiff's face.
"Don't worry, I won't be indiscriminate."
He seized the wheel again.
"I like having the power, though. I really like it. The idea of using it sort of arouses me. Hey, will you look at that? The suns are coming out."
The parting clouds allowed a few beams through when they lit the island, which was within half a mile of them now. The visitors' approach had been noticed. Guards had appeared on the cliff top and along the prison's parapet. Figures could be seen hurrying down the steps that wound down the cliff face, heading for the boats moored at its base. From the shore behind them rose the clamour of birds.
"They finally woke up," Gentle said.
Pye looked around. Sunlight was lighting the beach, and the wings of the birds as they rose in a squalling cloud.
"Oh, jeez you," Pye said.
"What's wrong?"
"The sea."
Pye didn't need to explain, for the same phenomenon that was crossing the cradle's surface behind them was now coming to meet them from the island, a slow shock wave, changing the nature of the matter it passed through. Gentle picked up speed, closing the gap between the vehicle and solid ground, but the road had already liquefied completely at the island's shore, and the message of transformation was spreading at speed.
"Stop the car!" Pye yelled. "If we don't get out, we'll go down in it!"
Gentle brought the car to a skidding halt, and they flung themselves out. The ground beneath them was still solid enough to run on, but they could feel tremors in it as they went, prophesying dissolution.
"Can you swim?"
Gentle called to Pye.
"If I have to,"
the Mistiff replied, its eyes on the approaching tide. The water looked mercurial and seemed to be full of thrashing fish.
"But I don't think this is something we want to bathe in, Gentle."
"I don't think we're going to have any choice."
There was at least some hope of rescue. Boats were being launched off the island's shore, the sound of the oars and the rhythmical shouts of the oarsmen rising above the churning of the silver water. The Mistiff wasn't looking for hope from that source, however. Its eyes had found a narrow causeway, like a path of softening ice, between where they stood and the land. Grabbing Gentle's arm, it pointed the way.
"I see it,"
Gentle replied, and they headed off along this zigzag route, checking on the position of the two boats as they went. The oarsmen had comprehended their strategy and changed direction to intercept them. Though the flood was eating at their causeway from either side, The possibility of escape had just seemed plausible, when the sound of the car upending and slipping into the waters distracted Gentle from his dash. He turned and collided with Pi as he did so. The Mistiff went down, falling on its face. Gentle hauled it back onto its feet, but it was momentarily too dazed to know their jeopardy. There were shouts of alarm coming from the boats now, and the frenzy of water yards from their heels. Gentle half-hoisted Pi onto his shoulders and picked up the race again. Precious seconds had been lost, however. The lead boat was within 20 yards of them, but the tide was half that distance behind and half again between his feet and the bow. If he stood still, the flow beneath him would go before the boat reached them. If he tried to run, burdened with a semi-conscious Mistiff, he'd miss his rendezvous with his rescuers. As it was, the choice was taken from him. The ground beneath the combined weight of man and Mistiff fractured, and the silver waters of Shazemit bubbled up between his feet. He heard a shout of alarm from the creature in the nearest boat, an Ethak, huge-headed and scarred, then felt his right leg lose 6 inches as his foot plunged through the brittle flow. It was Pi's turn to haul him up now, but it was a lost cause. The ground would support neither of them. In desperation, he looked down at the waters that he was going to have to swim in. The creatures he'd seen thrashing were not in the sea, but of the sea. The wavelets had backs and necks. The glitter of the spume was the glitter of countless tiny eyes. The boat was still speeding in their direction, and for an instant it seemed they might bridge the gap with a lunge.
"Go!"
he yelled to Pi, pushing as he did so. Though the Mistiff flailed, there was sufficient power in its legs to turn the fall into a jump. Its fingers caught the edge of the boat, but the violence of its leap threw Gentle from his precarious perch. He had time to see the Mistiff being hauled onto the rocking boat, and time, too, to think he might reach the hands outstretched in his direction. But the sea was not about to be denied both its morsels. As he dropped into the silver spume, which pressed around him like a living thing, he threw his hands up above his head in the hope that the Ethak would catch hold of him. All in vain. Consciousness went from him, and uncaptained, he sank.
Chapter 26. 1. Gentle woke to the sound of a prayer. He knew, before sight came to join the sound, that the words were a beseechment, though the language was foreign to him. The voices rose and fell in the same unmelodious fashion as did earth congregations, one or two of the half-dozen speakers lagging a syllable behind, leaving the verses ragged. But it was nevertheless a welcome sound. He'd gone down thinking he'd never rise again. Light touched his eyes, but whatever lay in front of him was murky. There was a vague texture to the gloom, however, and he tried to focus upon it. It wasn't until his brow, cheeks, and chin reported their irritation to his brain that he realized why his eyes couldn't make sense of the scene. He was lying on his back, and there was a cloth over his face. He told his arm to rise and pluck it away, but the limb just lay stupid at his side. He concentrated, demanding it obey, his irritation growing as the timbre of the supplications changed and a distressing urgency came into them. He felt the bed he was lying on jostled, and tried to call out in alarm, but there was something in his throat that prevented him from making a sound. Irritation became unease. What was wrong with him? "Be calm," he told himself. "It'll come clear. Just be calm." But damn it, the bed was being lifted up. Where was he being taken? To hell with calm. He couldn't just lie still while he was paraded around. He wasn't dead, for God's sake. Or was he? The thought shredded every hope of equilibrium. He was being lifted up and carried, lying inert on a hard board, with his face beneath a shroud. What was that, if it wasn't dead? They were saying prayers for his soul, hoping to waft it heavenward, meanwhile carrying his remains to what dispatch? A hole in the ground? A pyre? He had to stop them, raise a hand, a moan, anything to signal that this leave-taking was premature. As he was concentrating on making a sign, however primitive, a voice cut through the prayers, both
Prayers and beer-bearers stumbled to a halt, and the same voice, it was Pi, came again.
"Not yet," it said.
Somebody off to Gentle's right murmured something in a language Gentle didn't recognize. Words of consolation, perhaps. The mistiff responded in the same tongue, its voice fractured with grief. A third speaker now entered the exchange, his purpose undoubtedly the same as his compatriots, coaxing Pi to leave the body alone. What were they saying? That the corpse was just a husk, an empty shadow of a man whose spirit was gone into a better place? Gentle willed Pi not to listen. The spirit was here. Here! Then, joy of joys, the shroud was pulled back from his face, and Pi appeared in his field of vision staring down at him. The mistiff looked half dead itself, its eyes raw, its beauty bruised with sorrow. I'm saved, Gentle thought. Pi sees that my eyes are open, and there's more than putrefaction going on in my skull. But no such comprehension came into Pi's face. The sight simply brought a new burst of tears. A man came to Pi's side, his head a cluster of crystalline growths, and laid his hands on the mistiff's shoulders, whispering something in its ear and gently tugging it away. Pi's fingers went to Gentle's face and lay for a few seconds close to his lips, but his breath, which he'd used to shatter the wall between dominions, was so piffling now it went unfelt, and the fingers were withdrawn by the hand of Pi's consoler, who then reached down and drew the shroud back over Gentle's face. The prayer sayers picked up their dirge, and the bearers their burden. Blinded again, Gentle felt the spark of hope extinguished, replaced with panic and anger. Pi had always claimed such sensitivity. How was it possible that now, when empathy was essential, the mistiff could be immune to the jeopardy of the man it claimed as a friend? More than that, a soulmate, someone it had reconfigured its flesh for. Gentle's panic slowed for an instant. Was there some half-hope buried amid these rebukes? He scoured them for a clue. Soulmate? Reconfigured flesh? Yes, of course, as long as he had thought he had desire, and desire could touch the mistiff, change the mistiff. If he could put death from his mind and turn his thoughts to sex, he might still touch Pi's protean core, bring about some metamorphosis, however small, that would signal his sentience. As if to confound him, a remark of Klein's drifted into his head, recalled from another world. "All that time wasted," Klein had said, "meditating on death to keep yourself from coming too soon." The memory seemed mere distraction, until he realized that it was precisely the mirror of his present plight. Desire was now his only defense against premature extinction. He turned his thoughts to the little details that were always a stimulus to his erotic imagination. A nape, bared by lifted curls, lips re-wetted by a slow tongue, looks, touches, dares. But Thanatos had Eros by the neck. His terror drove arousal away. How could he hold a sexual thought in his head long enough to influence Pi when either the flame or the grave was waiting at his feet? He was ready for neither. One was too hot, the other too cold. One bright, the other so very dark. What he wanted was a few more weeks, days, hours even, he'd be grateful for hours in the space between such poles, where flesh was, where love was. Knowing the death thoughts couldn't be mastered, he attempted one final gambit, to embrace them, to fold them into the texture of his sexual imaginings. Flame? Let that be the heat of the mistiff's body as it was pressed against him, and cold the sweat on his back as they coupled. Let the darkness be a night that concealed their excesses, and the pyre blaze like their mutual consumption. He could feel the trick working as he thought this through. Why should death be so unerotic? If they blistered or rotted together, mightn't their dissolution show them new ways to love, uncovering them layer by layer and joining their moistures and their marrows until they were utterly mingled? He'd proposed marriage to Pi and been accepted. The creature was his to have and hold, to make over and over in the image of his fondness and most forbidden desires. He did so now. He saw the creature naked and astride him, changing even as he touched it, throwing off skins like clothes. Jude was one of those skins, and Vanessa another, and Martine another still. They were all riding him high, the beauty of the world impaled on his prick. Lost in this fantasy, he wasn't even aware that the prayers had stopped, until the bier was halted once again. There were whispers all around him, and in the middle of the whispers, soft and astonished laughter. The shroud was snatched away, and his beloved was looking down at him, grinning through features blurred by tears and gentle's influence.
"He's alive! Jesus, he's alive!"
There were doubting voices raised, but the mystiff laughed them down.
"I feel him in me," it said. "I swear it! He's still with us! Put him down! Put him down!"
The pallbearers did as they were instructed, and Gentle had his first glimpse of the strangers who'd almost bade him farewell. Not a happy bunch, even now. They stared down at the body, still disbelieving, but the danger was over, at least for the time being. The mystiff leaned over Gentle and kissed his lips. Its face was fixed once more, its features exquisite in their joy.
"I love you," it murmured to Gentle. "I love you until the death of love."
2. Alive he was, but not healed. He was moved to a small room of grey brick and laid on a bed only marginally more comfortable than the boards they'd laid him on as a corpse. There was a window, but being unable to move, he had to rely upon Pai Opa to lift him up and show him the view through it, which was scarcely more interesting than the walls, being simply an expanse of sea, solid once again, under a cloudy sky.
"The sea only changes when the suns come out," Pai explained, "which isn't very often. We were unlucky. But everyone is amazed that you survived. Nobody who fell into the cradle ever came out alive before."
That he was something of a curiosity was evidenced by the number of visitors he had, both guards and prisoners. The regime seemed to be fairly relaxed from what little he could judge. There were bars on the windows, and the door was unbolted and bolted up again when anybody came or went, but the officers, particularly the Ethak who ran the asylum, named Vigor Nashap, and his number two, a military peacock named Aping, whose buttons and boots shone a good deal more brightly than his eyes, and whose features drooped on his head as though sodden, were polite enough.
"They get no news out here," Pai explained. "They just get sent prisoners to look after. Nashap knows there was a plot against the Otak, but I don't believe he knows whether it's been successful or not. They've quizzed me for hours, but they haven't really asked about us. I just told them we were friends of Skopeek's, and we'd heard he'd lost his sanity, so we came to visit him. All innocence, in other words, and they seemed to swallow it. But they get supplies of food, magazines, and newspapers every 8 or 9 days, always out of date, Aping says. So our luck may not hold out too long. Meanwhile, I'm doing what I can to keep them both happy. They get very lonely."
The significance of this last remark wasn't lost on Gentle, but all he could do was listen and hope his healing wouldn't take too long. There was some easing in his muscles, allowing him to open and close his eyes, swallow, and even move his hands a little, but his torso was still completely rigid. His other regular visitor, and by far the most entertaining of those who came to Gork, was Skopeek, who had an opinion on everything, including the patient's rigidity. He was a tiny man, with the perpetual squint of a watchmaker, and a nose so upturned and so tiny his nostrils were virtually two holes in the middle of his face, which was already gouged with laugh lines deep enough to plant in. Every day he would come and sit on the edge of Gentle's bed, his grey asylum clothes as crumpled as his features, his glossy black wig never in the same place on his pate from hour to hour. Sitting, sipping coffee, he'd pontificate. On politics, on the various psychoses of his fellow inmates, on the subjugation of Limby by commerce, on the deaths of his friends, mostly by what he called despair's slow sword, and, of course, on Gentle's condition. He had seen people made rigid in such a fashion before, he claimed. The reason was not physiological, but psychological, a theory which seemed to carry weight with Pai. Once, when Skopeek had left after a session of theorizing, leaving Pi and Gentle alone, the Mistiff poured out its guilt. None of this would have come about, it said, if it had been sensitive to Gentle's situation from the beginning. Instead, it had been crude and unkind. The incident on the platform at Mykere was a case in point. Would Gentle ever forgive it? Ever believe that its actions were the product of ineptitude, not cruelty? Over the years it had wondered what would happen if they ever took the journey they were taking, and had tried to rehearse its responses, but it had been alone in the Fifth Dominion, unable to confess its fears or share its hopes, and the circumstances of their meeting and departure had been so haphazard that those few rules it had set itself had been thrown to the wind.
"Forgive me," it said over and over. "I love you, and I've hurt you, but please forgive me."
Gentle expressed what little he could with his eyes, wishing his fingers had the strength to hold a pen so that he could simply write, "I do." But the small advances he'd made since his resurrection seemed to be the limit of his healing, and though he was fed and bathed by Pi, and his muscles massaged, there was no sign of further improvement. Despite the Mistiff's constant words of encouragement, there was no doubt that death still had its finger in him. In them both, in fact. For Pi's devotion seemed to be taking its own toll, and more than once, Gentle wondered if the Mistiff's dwindling was simply fatigue, or whether they were symbiotically linked after their time together. If so, his demise would surely take them both to oblivion. He was alone in his cell the day the suns came out again, but Pi had left him sitting up with a view through the bars, and he was able to watch the slow unfurling of the clouds and the appearance of the subtlest beams falling on the solid sea. This was the first time since their arrival that the suns had broken over the Jessamit, and he heard a chorus of welcome from other cells, then the sound of running feet as guards went to the parapet to watch the transformation. He could see the surface of the cradle from where he was sitting, and felt a kind of exhilaration at the imminent spectacle, but as the beams brightened he felt a tremor climbing through his body from his toes, gathering force as it went until by the time it reached its head it had force enough to throw his senses from his skull. At first he thought he'd stood up and run to the window. He was peering out through the bars at the sea below, but a noise at the door drew his gaze around, to meet the sight of Scopeek, with Aping at his side, crossing the cell to the sallow, bearded derelict, sitting with a glazed expression against the far wall. He was that man.
"You have to come and see Zacharias," Scopeek was enthusing, putting his arm beneath the derelict and hoisting him up.
Aping lent a hand, and together they began to carry Gentle to the window, from which his mind was already departing. He left them to their kindness, the exhilaration he'd felt like an engine in him. Out and along the dreary corridor he went, passing cells in which prisoners were clamouring to be released to see the suns. He had no sense of the building's geography, and for a few moments his speeding soul lost its way in the maze of grey brick, until he encountered two guards hurrying up a flight of stone stairs and went with them, an invisible mind, into a brighter suite of rooms. There were more guards here, forsaking games of cards to head out into the open air.
"Where's Captain Nushup?" one of them said. "I'll go and tell him," another said, and broke from his comrades towards a closed door, only to be called back by another who told him, "He's in conference with the Mistiff,"
the reply winning a ribald laugh from his fellows. Turning his spirits back on the open air, Gentle flew towards the door, passing through it without harm or hesitation. The room beyond was not, as he'd expected, Nushup's office, but an antechamber, occupied by two empty chairs and a bare table. On the wall behind the table hung a painting of a small child, so wretchedly rendered the subject's sex was indeterminate. To the left of the picture, which was signed Aping, lay another door, as securely closed as the one he'd just passed through. But there was a voice audible from the far side, Vigor Nushup, in a little ecstasy.
"Again, again," he was saying. Then an outpouring in a foreign tongue, followed by cries of, "Yes!" and, "There! There!"
Gentle went to the door too quickly to prepare himself for what lay on the other side. Even if he had, even if he'd conjured the sight of Nushup with his breeches down and his ethac prick purple, he could not have imagined Pi O'Par's condition, given that in all their months together he had never once seen the Mistiff naked. Now he did, and the shock of its beauty was second only to that of its humiliation. It had a body as serene as its face, and as ambiguous, even in plain sight. There was no hair on any part of it, nor nipples, nor navel. Between its legs, however, which were presently spread as it knelt in front of Nashap, was the source of its transforming self, the core its couplers touched with thought. It was neither phallic nor vaginal, but a third genital form entirely, fluttering at its groin like an agitated dove, and with every flutter reconfiguring its glistening heart, so that Gentle, mesmerized, found a fresh echo in each motion. His own flesh was mirrored there, unfolding as it passed between dominions. So was the sky above Parashokwa, and the sea beyond the shuttered window, turning its solid back to living water, and breath blown into a closed fist, and the power breaking from it, all there, all there. Nashap was disdainful at the sight. Perhaps in his heat he didn't even see it. He had the mistiff's head clamped between his scarred hands, and was pushing the sharp tip of his member into its mouth. The mistiff made no objection. Its hands hung by its sides until Nashap demanded their attention upon his shaft. Gentle could bear the sight no longer. He pitched his mind across the room towards the Ethak's back. Hadn't he heard Skopeek say that thought was power? If so, Gentle thought, I'm a mote, diamond hard. Gentle heard Nashap gasp with pleasure as he pierced the mistiff's throat. Then he struck the Ethak's skull. The room disappeared, and hot meat pressed on him from all sides, but his momentum carried him out the other side, and he turned to see Nashap's hands go from the mistiff's head to his own, a shriek of pain coming from his lipless mouth. Pai's face, slack until now, filled with alarm as blood poured from Nashap's nostrils. Gentle felt a thrill of satisfaction at the sight, but the mistiff rose and went to the officer's assistance, picking up a piece of its own discarded clothing to help staunch the flow. Nashap twice waved its help away at first, but Pai's pliant voice softened him, and after a time the captain sank back in his cushioned chair and allowed himself to be tended. The mistiff's cooings and caresses were almost as distressing to Gentle as the scene he'd just interrupted, and he retreated, confounded and repulsed, first to the door, then through it into the antechamber. There he lingered, his sight fixed upon Aping's picture. In the room behind him, Nashap had begun to moan again. The sound drove Gentle out, through the labyrinth and back to his room. Skopeek and Aping had laid his body back on the bed. His face was devoid of expression, and one of his arms had slid from his chest and hung off the edge of the boards. He looked dead already. Was it any wonder Pai's devotion had become so mechanical, when all it had before it to inspire hope of recovery was this gaunt mannequin day in, day out? He drew closer to the body, half tempted never to enter it again, to let it wither and die. But there was too much risk in that. Suppose his present state was conditional upon the continuance of his physical self. Thought without flesh was certainly possible. He'd heard Skopeek pronounce on the subject in this very cell, but not, he guessed, for spirits so unevolved as his. Skin, blood, and bone were the school in which the soul learned flight, and he was still too much a fledgling to dare truancy. He had to go, vile as that notion was, back behind the eyes. He went one more time to the window, and looked out at the glittering sea. The sight of its waves beating at the rocks below brought back the terror of his drowning. He felt the living waters squirming around him, pressing at his lips like Nashap's prick, demanding he open up and swallow. In horror, he turned from the sight and crossed the room at speed, striking his brow like a bullet. Returning into his substance with the images of Nashap and sea on his mind, he comprehended instantly the nature of his sickness. Skopeek had been wrong, all wrong. There was a solid, oh so solid, physiological reason for his inertia. He felt it in his belly, now wretchedly real. He'd swallowed some of the waters, and they were still inside him, living, prospering at his expense. Before intellect could caution him, he let his revulsion loose upon his body, threw his demands into each extremity. Move, he told them, move! He fueled his rage with the thought of Nashap using him as he'd used Pai, imagining the Ethak's semen in his belly. His left hand found power enough to take hold of the bedboard, its purchase sufficient to pull him over. He toppled onto his side, then off the bed entirely, hitting the floor hard. The impact dislodged something in the base of his belly. He felt it scrabble to catch hold of his innards again, its motion violent enough to throw him around like a sack full of thrashing fish, each twist unseating the parasite a little more and in turn releasing his body from its tyranny. His joints cracked like walnut shells, his sinews stretched and shortened. It was agony, and he longed to shriek his complaint, but all he could manage was a retching sound. It was still music, the first sound he'd made since the yell he'd given as the cradle swallowed him up. It was short-lived, however. His racked system was pushing the parasite up from his stomach. He felt it in his chest, like a meal of hooks he longed to vomit up but could not, for fear he'd turn himself inside out in the attempt. It seemed to know they'd reached an impasse, because its flailing slowed and he had time to draw a desperate breath through pipes half clogged by its presence. With his lungs as full as he had hope of getting them, he hauled himself up off the ground by clinging to the bed, and before the parasite had time to incapacitate him with a fresh assault, he stood to his full height, then threw himself face down. As he hit the ground, the thing came up into his throat and mouth in a surge, and he reached between his teeth to snatch it out of him. It came with two pulls, fighting to the end to crawl back down his gullet. It was followed immediately by his last meal. Gasping for air, he dragged himself upright and leaned against the bed, strings of puke hanging from his chin. The thing on the floor flapped and flailed, and he let it suffer. Though it had felt huge when inside him, it was no bigger than his hand, a formless scrap of milky flesh and silver vein, with limbs no thicker than string, but fully 20 in number. It made no sound except for the slap its spasms made in the bilious mess on the cell floor. Too weak to move, Gentle was still slumped against the bed when, some minutes later, Scopeek came back to look for Pi. Scopeek's astonishment knew no bounds. He called for help, then hoisted Gentle back onto the bed, question following question so fast Gentle barely had breath or energy to answer. But sufficient was communicated for Scopeek to berate himself for not grasping the problem earlier.
"I thought it was in your head, Zacharias, and all the time it was in your belly, this bastard thing."
Aping arrived and there was a new round of questions, answered this time by Scopeek, who then went off in search of Pi, leaving the guard to arrange for the filth on the floor to be cleaned up, and the patient brought fresh water and clean clothes.
"Is there anything else you need?"
Aping wanted to know.
"Food,"
Gentle said. His belly had never felt emptier.
"It'll be arranged. It's strange to hear your voice and see you move. I got used to you the other way,"
he smiled.
"When you're feeling stronger," he said, "we must find some time to talk. I hear from the Mistiff you're a painter."
"I was, yes,"
said Gentle, adding an innocent inquiry.
"Why, are you?"
Aping beamed.
"I am,"
he said.
"Then we must talk," Gentle said. "What do you paint?"
"Landscapes. Some figures."
"Nudes? Portraits?"
"Children."
"Ah, children. Do you have any yourself?"
A trace of anxiety crossing Aping's face.
"Later,"
he said, glancing out towards the corridor, then back at Gentle.
"In private."
"I'm at your disposal," Gentle replied.
There were voices outside the room. Scopeek returning with Nashap, who glanced down into the bucket containing the parasite as he entered. There were more questions, or rather the same rephrased, and answered on this third occasion by both Scopeek and Aping. Nashap listened with only half an ear, studying Gentle as the drama was recounted, then congratulating him with a curious formality. Gentle noted with satisfaction the plugs of dried blood in his nose.
"We must make a full account of this incident to Isodrex,"
Nashap said.
"I'm sure it will intrigue them as much as it does me."
So saying, he left, with an order to Aping that he follow immediately.
"Our commander looked less than well," Scopeek observed. "I wonder why."
Gentle allowed himself a smile, but it went from his face at the sight of his final visitor. Pi O'Parr had appeared in the door.
"Ah, well," said Scopeek, "here you are. I'll leave you two alone."
He withdrew, closing the door behind him. The Mistiff didn't move to embrace Gentle or even take his hand. Instead it went to the window and gazed out over the sea, upon which the suns were still shining.
"Now we know why they call this the cradle," it said.
"What do you mean?
Where else could a man give birth?"
"That wasn't birth," Gentle said. "Don't flatter it."
"Maybe not to us," Pye said, "but who knows how children were made here in ancient times? Maybe the men immersed themselves, drank the water, let it grow."
"I saw you," Gentle said.
"I know," Pye replied, not turning from the window. "And you almost lost us both an ally."
"Nashap, an ally?"
"He's the power here."
"He's an Aethak, and he's scum, and I'm going to have the satisfaction of killing him."
"Are you my champion now?" Pye said, finally looking back at Gentle.
"I saw what he was doing to you."
"That was nothing," Pye replied. "I knew what I was doing. Why do you think we've had the treatment we've had? I've been allowed to see Skopeak whenever I want. You've been fed and watered. And Nashap was asking no questions about either of us. Now he will. Now he'll be suspicious. We'll have to move quickly before he gets his questions answered."
"Better that than you having to service him."
"I told you it was nothing."
"It was to me," Gentle said,
the words scraping in his bruised throat. It took some effort, but he got to his feet so as to meet the Mistiff eye to eye.
"At the beginning, you talked to me about how you thought you'd hurt me, remember? You kept talking about the station at my care, and saying you wanted me to forgive you, and I kept thinking there would never be anything between us that couldn't be forgiven or forgotten, and that when I had the words again I'd say so. But now I don't know. He saw you naked, Pye. Why him and not me? I think that's maybe unforgivable, that you granted him the mystery, but not me."
"He saw no mystery," Pye replied. "He looked at me, and he saw a woman he'd loved and lost in his Ordorax, a woman who looked like his mother, in fact. That's what he was obsessing on, an echo of his mother's echo. And as long as I kept supplying the illusion discreetly, he was compliant. That seemed more important than my dignity."
"Not anymore," Gentle said. "If we're to go from here together, then I want whatever you are to be mine. I won't share you, Pye. Not for compliance. Not for life itself."
"I didn't know you felt like this. If you'd told me..."
"I couldn't. Even before we came here, I felt it, but I couldn't bring myself to say anything.
For what it's worth, I apologize."
"I don't want an apology."
"What then?"
"A promise. An oath."
He paused.
"A marriage."
The Mistiff smiled.
"Really? More than anything. I asked you once and you accepted. Do I need to ask again? I will if you want me to."
"No need," Pye said. "Nothing would honor me more."
"But here? Here of all places?"
The Mistiff's frown became a grin.
"Skopeak told me about a dirther who's locked up in the basement. He could do the honors."
"What's his religion?"
"He's here because he thinks he's Jesus Christ."
"Then he can prove it with a miracle."
"What miracle's that?"
"He can make an honest man of John Fury Zacharias."
3. The marriage of the Yuhtamak Mistiff and the fugitive John Fury Zacharias, called Gentle, took place that night in the depths of the asylum. Happily, their priest was passing through a period of lucidity and was willing to be addressed by his real name, Father Athanasius. He bore the evidence of his dementia, however. Scars on his forehead, where the crowns of thorns he repeatedly fashioned and wore, had dug deep, and